You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
City Limits. Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9am.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Okay, once again, the acres and acres of tar and cement get us to City Limits. And here we are, Kevin Healy sitting over this side, Zeb Peake over that side. Zeb,
hello.
How are you?
I'm well.
Good. Yes. That's lovely to hear. Yeah. A cold morning out there. I'm riding across this morning. I took off and I thought I should have put a warmer jumper on under my jacket here. But anyway, but it was like, once you get riding along, you warm up and it's all okay.
Yeah. And once you're in this room, it's toasty.
Ah, that's right. It is. So breakfast time, of course, that's why it's toasty. And City Limits today is a second Wednesday of the month, so we look at energy and related type issues and things to do with, climate, etc. And we're going to be talking in the second half of the program to one of our regulars, Helen Vandenberg, who, of course, we know is particularly interested in areas around water and waterways and also the toxic waste up at Tullamarine and among other things. And I know this morning she does want to spend a bit of time talking to us about and something we've talked about a fair bit on this program, including with David Spratt a fortnight ago when you were here, Zeb, but AI and the call centres that are, are amazingly... energy and water intensive, but particularly the water intensive bit, which it seems to be being ignored, and quite concerning and quite disturbing to Helen and any of us who think about it. So we'll be talking to her about those things. Plus, of course, I noticed in today's paper they say the algal bloom in Western and South Australia is getting worse, in fact, rather than better. And they may have to close all the beaches all summer this year.
Awful news. Yeah.
Bloody terrible. And there's other things to do with water as well. Like there was a report that, and something else Helen's talked about a fair bit, a report in the last week or two saying governments need to do something about the residue that comes off tyres on roads, including small specks of plastic off tyres that get into waterways, and they claim they're one of the major pollutants of our waterways and streams at the moment, and that needs to be addressed, and it's something that Helen's been talking about for a long, long time. So we'll get on to all those things.
Yes. Yeah, that's a cheery little program. A joyous program.
Oh, nothing like cheering people up, no end. Cup of tea here.
Yes, please.
Zeb, okay. It's the same as last. Well, it's not the same tea exactly as last week, as we drank that. But it is again. It's a Vietnamese green tea today. So,
lovely.
Are. Yes.
Okay.
Now there's a sort of dark glass that says Barkindji Dreamtime, and it's got sort of Aboriginal art on it. Or there's one with some flowers, grey with flowers, or the flowers. Yeah, I suppose they're flowers, little things. Yeah, what do you think?
I have the Barkindji Dreamtime?
Okay, yep,
please.
Sure, that's yours. There you are. Okay, and I'll have the other one. Here we go. Sip of tea. People will know we're drinking tea. There we go. Radio off to a big start.
Yes.
Now, an item I wasn't going to mention at the start of the program, but... due to a story I've just noticed in the front page, and in fact it's on page 3, but referred to from the front page of this morning's Financial Review, we've mentioned a few times, and I know I made a point of it on the week that was the other week, about Julie Bishop as the Chancellor of ANU. And in fact, it cost her about $800,000 a year to have her as Chancellor. They provide an office for her in Perth. Now, you're probably aware of this. You probably noticed, by the way, Zeb, that ANU happens to be in Canberra, but she does her chancelling from her office in a high-rise tower in Perth.
Mm-hmm.
But she does go over, she flies over, but then the costs of flying are there and back are also extraordinary for ANU. So that adds up to about $800,000 a year, plus she's got two staff members who are paid for by ANU, but they're also on the they're also staff members of her private consultancy company. There's all these things happening. Plus, they spent $800,000 just setting up the office for her in Perth anyway. So she's been pretty costly, but she obviously saves the money because they're in deep debt, and they've got a chancellor, a vice chancellor who goes along with Julie totally. So they're slashing staff, they're slashing courses madly, at the same time as all this money's going around. And in fact, this week it was announced, and this isn't the story this morning, but this week it was announced that it's very clever for a music school. They've had one of the best music schools in the country, apart from the, well, probably along with the conservatoriums. And the students claim that the teachers who teach them the instruments are the best in the world, virtually. They're wonderful teachers of instruments. But in cost slashing, they've cut back instrument teaching in the music school. So the music school is going to be basically all music theory, but you can come out without having to know how to play a note, which does seem to be a bit self-destructive, certainly against what one might think a music school should do. If you emerge and not able to play, one would have thought that being able to play an instrument is a fairly important ingredient in a music school.
Yeah, one would think that, but you forget, Kevin. People don't make decisions based on logic.
No, well, that's also happened this week. Well, this morning's story is. And I'll read the first few paragraphs, and it's pretty awful, actually. Four current and former members of the Australian National University Council have testified to a Senate inquiry about an atmosphere of threats and intimidation, including allegations Chancellor Julie Bishop blocked a door during a heated meeting. In an emotional session, former council member Dr. Liz Allen said she had considered suicide after being accused by Bishop and Vice-Chancellor Genevieve Bell of, quote, improper and illegal activity, including leaking information to the media and making personal gain from those leaks. She said Bishop laughed at her when she became upset and stopped her from leaving the room. Allen, whose decision to quit was first reported in this paper, became visibly distressed during her evidence as she recounted how she was told by Bishop she had defamed the council and would be subject to legal action. At no time have I leaked confidential council business, Allen told the inquiry chaired by South Australian Labor Senator Mariel Smith. I was threatened and became extremely fearful. Bishop laughed at my emotional response and at one point blocked me from leaving the room. I was so distressed I couldn't breathe and struggled walking. I felt violated and deeply humiliated. And it goes on and on and on. She said she got to the stage she wanted to kill herself. And students now have come out. Will Barfoot, who is president of ANU Student Union and the student representative on the council, told the inquiry he also held serious concerns. My time on council has shown to me that there are serious issues with how the governance body operates, issues the community and indeed this parliament would consider unacceptable for an institution the size and significance of ANU. And of course, Bishop has denied the whole thing, etc. But that's just a latest in that development. But it's a real pity because ANU has such a wonderful reputation, but they're not doing it much good at the moment. No, so that's one I just threw in because it was there, basically.
Yeah, just to make us even more sad.
Yeah. Now, most of the media gave a reasonably objective coverage to the government suddenly changing its mind and deciding to recognise Palestinian state.
Mm-hmm.
One might have thought there's a bit of pressure on them, both from rallies around the country for 17 or 18 months or whatever it now is, going on for 2 years, or it's more than that because it's 2 years in October. But also, as the Financial Review pointed out very clearly, there was massive pressure from within the Labor Party and in the Labor caucus itself to act urgently on the matter, And so finally, Albanese gave in, and he's done it. But the if you wanted to get a truly objective coverage of what really happened, I think you only had to turn to yesterday's Herald Sun.
Oh, no.
Yes, my word. Big front page, a win for Hamas. Jewish groups accuse PM of shocking betrayal after backing Palestinian state. There you are. And then there were four more pages inside. It's just a complete mess. And that's a quote from Susan Ley. So, you know, my goodness, what a surprise she attacked it. And then there's divisive move won't do whatever, won't solve it, or won't stop the hate, won't stop the hate. Police pan all vibe, no action. Hamas will only be isolated. Albanese's Palestinian call leaves no one happy. So it goes on and on for four pages of all that. Really great coverage of the whole thing, I would have thought. And, of course, overnight, or was it yesterday, whenever the Liberal Party has said that if it gets into government, which is, thank God, it won't for a while, I guess, it will, in fact, reverse the decision and unrecognise Palestine. So,
well, I think they just need to read the room at this point, because it's not just a small group on the left that are pro-Palestinian. It's the majority of people. The majority of people can see, at the very least, that murdering children is bad. So, yeah, I think I guess it's not surprising from the Liberals, but they may need to have a long, hard look at themselves.
Yes. I heard Michaela Cash yesterday morning, who's now their foreign affairs opposite to the very gut, the very gutsy Penny Wong. Penny has seen the light too recently. Suddenly also she talks about how we will continue to do, etc. And we didn't know they'd started to do. You know, they talk about continuing. Suddenly they've become all radical and mad. Like this morning I heard the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, saying how you know, it's so terrible what's happening, we need, etc., etc. Something they haven't said for almost 2 years, but suddenly they've seen the light, which is wonderful. But Michaela was really on about how awful it was that we were, you know, the usual line, we're rewarding terrorism and it's terrible, terrible. What I thought mostly about her interview, though, was you could understand if her elocution teacher committed suicide, couldn't you? I mean,
oh, gosh. I mean, yeah, we don't even need to, like, yeah.
I'm sure she was a senior partner with one of the biggest law firms in this country. I mean, if I hit court and someone said, oh, Michaela's going to represent you today, I think I would immediately plead guilty and throw myself at the mercy of the court. I wouldn't want to have... Anyway, that's my thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is, why are people still backing a genocide?
We need to answer that, don't we? I'm going to top up a bit to you. But do you want a bit more top up, or are you going okay there?
I'm going okay.
You just missed out, because I think we just emptied it anyway, so
okay.
That's it.
Phew.
Took care of that. There goes your chance.
Yeah.
As we're leading up to this this conference or this talk fest the government's going to have on productivity, and it was interesting that there was a report this week that, in fact, for a long time, productivity had increased to the point where workers could have worked less hours. Because the story was about, I've got to get it somewhere anyway, but the story here it is, living standards take a hit as Australians work longer hours. Australian workers could be putting in nearly half the hours they were 45 years ago. And in fact, it's always been said for years that as technology does all these things, and AI could do it, in fact, then people would need to work a lot less In fact, you could use it just a few hours a week if you wanted to, I suppose. But of course, it's only because of the profit motive and being forced. So, in fact, despite all that interest in the improvements in technology, people are working a lot more. But it makes the points that the growth in productivity since 1980, Australians could have instead worked an average of 15 hours less each week. This is a study by the Productivity Commission of all people. And that we're having this productivity conference to say that we need to improve productivity so workers can, and the bosses keep saying, because all they want to do is give workers better wages and conditions, but they need the workers need to work a bit harder in productivity. But there's a quote from the Productivity Commission: with the growth in productivity since 1980, Australians could have instead worked an average of 15 hours less each week without lowering consumption levels. How about that? So there you are. Now, that leads me up to this point that the government says it's now its debt is such, and debt's going to become worse in the next few years, that they're going to have to cut back funding, cut back spending in particular areas. And they've named, and this is interesting, they've named health, climate and energy, social services and attorney generals as the main ones, and they could have budget cuts as large as 50%. And find out where and in that find out where they need to cut workers. So it's pretty devastating because and they've picked. I don't see defence there, for instance.
Yeah, I was just thinking. I don't hear any mention of AUKUS.
No, it's not. AUKUS doesn't rate a mention here.
So odd.
No, that is strange, isn't it? And in fact. In a post-election review, the Parliamentary Budget Office forecast a 3% fall in the public service wage bill combined with a 10% increase in wages would mean 22,500 positions need to be axed for departments to stay within budget. Tania Plibersek, Social Services Department, is expected to have to cut 441 positions or 13% of the workforce this year. And it goes on and on about those areas. Michelle Rowland, the new Attorney General, says 32 programs were due to expire, resulting in an $81.2 million or 26.6% funding cut. Programs set to lose funding included elements of the National Strategy to Prevent and Respond to Child Sexual Abuse and the High Risk Terrorist Offenders Scheme, designed to manage people convicted of terrorism offences, etc. And social services forecast its budget would fall further by whatever. So it just goes on and on. When in fact, there's no need for it, as I see, because they could simply increase taxes on the rich and pay for all that. But as they say, they're locked in now because Albanese has declared there'll be no new taxes on the rich. So the only way is to cut services to the poor.
Yes. Correct.
And that's
yeah.
That's it. Now,
and this is from the government that had such a huge majority that they could do what they want.
Exactly.
And this is what they want to do.
That's right. And on election night, the Prime Minister said proudly as he stood up there feeling so elated, "No one will be left behind. No one will be left behind," he said. Which made me think any day now they're going to raise the dole and unemployed people will be having a cornucopia of riches and no one will be homeless and it's wonderful, but we haven't seen a start yet.
Yeah, that kind of implies that he doesn't think that poor people are anyone.
Well, that's true. Yes. Now, the same thing, unfortunately, is also happening at the state level. And the state government's now talking about having to cut jobs and cut services. And the people affected here would be Creative Victoria, Corporate Services, Economic Policy Programs and Services, Industry, Trade and Investment, Office of the Secretary, Regional Development, Skills and TAFE, Sport and Experience Economic Group and Victorian Skills Authority. Creative Victoria's creative investment team would be slashed under the proposal, which appears to cut every worker in music and screen. The final structure will be announced in September after consultation with staff, having said they're already going to sack so many workers. So I guess you consult about losing your job. And Giselle Hannah, of course, who's a actor, who's a long-time programmer on this station and still is, but has recently elected secretary of the union, CPSU. She said it's not even released yet, but this is the Silver Review slashing by stealth. The Silver Review is the review the government set up to look at all this, and it's about to be released, but they haven't released it yet. This needless austerity is already cutting essential services and jobs. We're fighting back and mobilising our growing membership. So we'll see what happens there, but we've got. But it's pretty awful when state and federal governments do that, when in fact the real solution is lying in them in the face, that all those filthy rich who pay no taxes whatever or very little and avoid it to a great degree, and the big international AI and other companies, the tech companies who move money around the world so they end up paying bugger all taxes here, if you hit them properly, we could pay for all that.
Yeah.
In fact, if we didn't have AUKUS, AUKUS is costing us, as we've said many times, $38 million a day.
Mm-hmm.
If you got that $38 million a day and put it in, say you rotated, Monday transport, Tuesday housing, Wednesday education, Thursday social security, Friday whatever else, health, after a while you'd have a pretty good service, I reckon.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay, well, you...
Thanks, Kevin. We've solved the problem.
We've solved it.
Yeah.
Well, there you are.
Well, I've got one news item that I found interesting, although also not so cheery, which is from The Guardian, a rise in dengue fever outbreaks across the Pacific driven by the climate crisis, experts say. The climate crisis is driving a sharp rise in dengue fever cases across the Pacific Islands as infections hit their highest level in a decade and several countries declare emergencies. So these warming and extra wet conditions are perfect for mosquitoes to breed. And the mosquito / dengue fever season is getting longer and longer. So something else to think about as our climate warms is that we're going to have a rise of these diseases that thrive in warm, wet conditions.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they're coming, I mean, we down here we're fairly safe from dengue fever, but if you go up north or even if you go, say, to the Murray River, and you're only going to go as far as the Murray north of in Victoria, up there you're always in danger of getting it. Around that part of the world. But, of course, everything is moving south, so it's going to come here fairly quickly. Well, we notice in the oceans, you know, certain marine life that used to be only in the tropical area are now coming further south all the time. And it's happening that, you know, there's all those changes are taking place. The oceans are... I heard a report on possibly on this station or the ABC in the last couple of weeks talking about climate change. The fact that part of the reason for the extreme weather conditions, and I can't explain it scientifically other than they said because the two poles are warming faster than the equator, the centre, it's sort of squeezing the Earth up in that sense. It was explained scientifically, and I can't go beyond that. But it's an interesting theory it's more than a theory. I think it's fact. They're saying it's fact. In fact, that the poles are warming faster, and therefore because the centre isn't warming as fast, somehow it's squeezing the Earth around, and that's one of the reasons for all this. And of course, we know that the Gulf Streams, etc., that come around Africa, and they're all changing, and they're forcing weather changes, etc. But so, you know, we're going to see more and more of these extreme weather conditions, and the dengue fever is just a good example of it, of course.
Yeah.
And on that, I notice overnight we've signed an agreement, and it's not a bad thing to do, with Vanuatu, although our motives are bad. Our motives are to get in before China does, rather than genuine you know, concern for the people of Vanuatu or the people of those islands. But that while we've signed agreements with various things like being able to work and giving them help for various things, there's still that problem they face with us that they consider, and it was Vanuatu who went to the International Court the other week, of course, that got that ruling about climate change. They're still concerned, of course, about Australia's attitude to climate change, which unfortunately is not good, despite what the government says. We can't keep approving coal, gas, oil, and say that we're addressing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's shameful.
Yeah, and we're literally sinking those people, literally sinking those people, including our own citizens in the north, in the Tiwi Islands, and in the Torres Strait Islands. So there you are. Yeah. Also, interesting that, and we're going to get Helen Bannerberg in a minute, but we'll have a break in a second and get Helen. There's been a big backlash against our Premier, Jessica Allen, what's her name? Whatever her name is,
Jacinta.
Allen.
Jacinta Allen.
yes, she's obviously won me over. But anyway, the old Jacinta at the ALP conference, her big winning one, which meant they didn't have to do anything about anything else, was they're going to legislate for work from home and people can work from home, and the bosses are screaming and yelling how this is going to end the world as we know it. It's a terrible thing. But coincidentally, the same weekend, there was a study in Sydney that showed that, and it probably wouldn't be much different here, that going to work costs workers about $400 a week, with petrol, lunches, tolls over there, where you've got tolls here as well, extended daycare costs, all sorts of things that cost you, which you would save if you stayed at home and worked from home. So it's just interesting that that going to work, they say, is an average of $400 a week for workers just to go to work.
Interesting. Yeah.
So Jacinta might be onto something by sheer accident.
Well, on that note, perhaps we'll go for a short break. If we can't speak to Helen straight away, we might come back and
She's at a meeting, so we've got to track her down at the meeting, but she is going to answer her phone at some stage very shortly, let's hope, and otherwise we're going to sit here and look pretty stupid. Or my case, more stupid than normal. In your case, you never look stupid.
Oh, thanks, Kevin.
That's all right.
All right.
Did you know 1 in 4 vehicle occupants killed on Victorian roads in the past 5 years were not wearing a seatbelt? In Victoria, it's a legal requirement for everyone in the vehicle to wear a seatbelt. Wearing one doubles your chances of surviving a crash and reduces the risk of serious injury by 50%. That's why barbers and hairdressers across Victoria are joining the Transport Accident Commission's Cut, Colour, Click campaign by starting important conversations in salons and barbershops about seatbelt safety. Jackie Sampson, Head of Community at the TAC, says these everyday chats can help save lives.
We are equipping salons and barbershops to be road safety hubs. We're offering tailored information about seatbelt safety via QR codes and posters. The barber smocks feature a seatbelt sash and the tagline, "Seatbelts keep us together." This will be available in up to 10 different languages to ensure that we engage as many Victorians as possible in this initiative.
Always buckle up. Every seat, every trip. Find out more at seatbeltstogether.com.au.
A 3CR supporter.
Okay, on the line we've got Helen Vandenberg, who is a Well, she's a regular on this program, and she's irregular, whatever I say. And but Helen, a great activist in the western and northwestern suburbs of Melbourne. And Helen, today, look, I'll start open with this one because in this morning's paper, it says that Susan Lee Sussenley is heading across to South Australia to have a look at the algal bloom, but it's been reported by scientists that it's actually getting worse, and they may now have to close the beaches all summer. You know, this is just another example of climate change affecting water, isn't it?
Well, I'm not an authority on that, but it's certainly what I intuitively think. It is of great concern. It is a reminder to everybody that we depend upon nature for so much. I mean, we breathe the air, we drink the water, we swim where we can in rivers and the oceans, and when things get out of balance, we're going to cop it. I can't remember the name of the American scientist who said, which is rather a formidable statement, water is the hammer which climate change will hit the earth with. And when you think of how often we drink during the day and our utter dependence upon having access to water, it is of great concern that our rivers are drying up rapidly. And what that puts at risk is a reliable potable water supply. It also puts at risk the species that live in the river, like platypus, eels, the water birds that go there to feed. The food web gets disrupted. And yet very little consideration. There's no sense of urgency in the Victorian government about water. So that's of great concern to the whole concerned waterways and lives. For instance, in the Maribyrnong, people drink from Jackson's Creek and they drink the groundwater around Lancefield that gets mixed with the water. Jackson's Creek has a reservoir at Roslyn Reservoir, which is only 60% full at the moment. Now, our river, since 2006, so 19 years ago, it was identified that our river needed 6 billion litres of fresh water extra in it to keep it healthy. Now, that's not only important for the river and for the platypus, for those that like to fish, it's also important for the health of the bay, that those fresh water impulses coming into the bay keep the bay in balance. So, and along the coastal areas, the rivers and creeks that flow into the ocean, those freshwater pulses create a particular balance that give you a very productive fisheries along the coast. So if we don't care for our freshwater rivers, we are changing the balance in so many systems, it's worrying. But the good news on top of all of that...
Well, this is city limits. Be careful here. Yes, good news.
No, there is good news. Because with this... well, of course, when we built our dams, we weren't imagining a city of 8 million people, were we? Now, we know that the Victorian community were fantastic during the Millennium Drought and they really reduced their water take-up, right? They really stuck to the 155 or less. Industry didn't do such a good job. Now, we have to keep agriculture going if we want to eat. There are industries that are vital to our existence as well. So all of this has to come into some kind of balance. But because we have an increased population drinking more water, we have more sewage waste. Now, the vast volume of our wastewater is not being used effectively, right? Because we haven't put the infrastructure in there to bring it up to a good quality water. Now, in the Sustainable Water Strategy in 2022, it said, oh, well, we can use all this recycled water for creating the environmental flows. So, in other words, the Maribyrnong could have the 19 years that we've been missing out on getting our 7 billion litres of water, that could become available. Well, we said that'd be fine provided it's going to support the life in the creek and recognise the creek, the waterways as living entities and support that system. Now, the technology exists to do that. And it means we can get recycled water up, we can get rid of all the toxins in it, and we can support the life of the river and those that want to fish and swim in it, which would be a good thing. The other thing we can do with recycled water is use it to cool data centres. And the other thing you could do with recycled water is bring it up to a potable water standard. So you can overcome, you can address some of the shortages by the better use of recycled wastewater. Unfortunately, I can't find any current commitment by the government to really accelerating that path, accelerating the application of current technology so that we could do that. And that's really disappointing because we talk about having a sustainable water strategy. We have an obvious way of relieving an urgent situation, and we don't seem to be getting any traction on it. And that directly comes back to, I believe, budgetary restraints. So I would like all the people in the Maribyrnong electorate, like Marianne Thomas and Ben Carroll and Danny Pearson and
These are the state members in those areas anyway.
Yeah, well, yeah. State members in those areas, I think if they became aware of it. Now, the data exists in the bureaucracy because that's what I mine to get my information from. I don't really know. Now, we have a new water minister, Gail Tierney, and she, all the background information that I've read about her is that she believes in listening to the community voice. Well, down in her area, they're in drought, so there's plenty of experience down there.
Which is her area?
The Western District of
Victoria. Right, okay.
Okay?
Yep.
So I'm hoping that the new Water Minister will be the woman who comes up here and says, yes, there is an urgent situation here and we need to address it and let's use available technology to get there. Now, one of the things, we all know that the west and the northwest of Melbourne, we took a big hit during the previous industrial revolution, industrialisation, right, post-war. We took the dirty jobs, we got filthy rivers and we got dirty air. And some people are still getting dusty air down in Brooklyn because roads haven't been paved. Now, we don't intend to be having been the impact zone again during this AI and data centre revolution that is upon us already. So what we're concerned about now is, according to the ABC report, the ABC News report, which they said they based their data on a freedom of information to Greater Western Water, they said there are about 19 data centres coming to the north and west of Melbourne. Now, as I've said, the Maribyrnong is already short of water for a healthy river. So is the Werribee, and yet we're the areas where there seems to be, they seem to be targeting. And you can understand why they go there, because land is cheaper where it's flatter. And guess what? They, according to that ABC report, will be using 20 billion litres of drinking water a year. Now, is that really the best use of water?
Yeah, well, that's just interesting on that. A study by the University of California just recently came out that shows that for every 1 billion queries on AI, it uses the same amount of water as a small town. And that 1 billion, that isn't a lot of queries when you consider the number of people using it.
Absolutely, Kevin. And what's more, they get there well, but at least in California, there is a system by which people have to report their water efficiency. We don't have such a requirement in Victoria. Now, if you look at it, if you look at the price of water, I've got my Greater Western Water bill here. Now, firstly, I want to say about Greater Western Water, the Maribyrnong River and Waterways Association has a very good relationship with them because we find them very open and willing to willing to discuss with us and help us understand all the infrastructure that they have, how it works, and what their plans are for improving it. I don't see any lack of ambition down in that water industry, right, in that water corporation. I think they're open-minded and they're respectful of community and traditional owners. Now, on my bill yesterday, it says that I have to pay, honestly, my water is so cheap, it's disgusting. I only have to pay $3.64 for 1,000 litres of water, right? Mm. Industry gets it at $3.20. Now, if I use more than 440 kilowatts in a day, the price jumps up to $4, right? Now, industry doesn't have any increment like that. I don't think that's a rational way of pricing water. Now, the price of water is set by the Essential Services Commission, and they usually get a directive from Treasury saying, keep the bills as low as you can. Well, in a time when people are having a crisis with being able to afford things, this a cost of living crisis, you can understand why that would be there, but it seems to be perpetual with them. If we constantly keep the cost of water below what it's worth, we're only going to finish up in a bigger mess. So I do think the federal and state governments have an obligation to look at how we are going to have an effective water grid, which is promised in the Sustainable Water Strategy, where all our pipes are uniform so we can switch water between where it's necessary. And yet that whole process is slowing down, right? Now, we need to make sure we've got an effective water grid, that we use current technology, and that we have a fair pricing for water. And at the moment, we don't have a fair, reasonable price. Yes, during the last drought, we were all urged to buy new washing machines that would be use less water. I don't understand why the data, the AI and the data centres are allowed to use drinking water when they could be cooling those massive towers of theirs with electricity. Clearly, they don't want to do that at the moment because electricity is more expensive than water. But when you consider how short we are of water, is that a rational response? I don't think so. So I really do think something needs to change pretty quickly. The Victorian government needs to act to say you could be using electricity to cool your systems. They could be coming up with a system where they're made to be accountable for the amount of water, and why can't they have recycled water anyhow for that rather than drinking water?
And the other side of that, of course, is that governments, particularly Victoria and New South Wales, are competing with each other to try to attract these places to come. They're actually giving them economic incentives to come and set up these data centres in Victoria and New South Wales.
Well, that's why the Victorian government made water cheaper for industry than it does for householders to attract investment. In some cases, that could be rational. But when water is so desperately short across this whole country, right, and when water is so desperately needed in the Maribyrnong River and in the Werribee River and in the Moorabool River and in the Barwon River and in the Yarra River, this is ridiculous. It's not logical. We have to just understand the circumstances we're in. And it doesn't seem to be urgently understood by the government yet, though their own bureaucracy has all the data they need.
Yeah, it's interesting that in New South Wales, the local council in at Macquarie Park, where a mob called NextDC want to put a $1.4 billion data centre, but the local council objected on the grounds of energy and water use. But unfortunately, the state government looks like overriding that, and the company's most upset because it slowed them down.
Well, of course, we all know that there is an attitude that says I'm more important than others. But that's not the case when it comes to drinking water. Everybody needs drinking water to survive every day. And it is not rational to be saying, to be letting people build, saying, well, you've got to switch to all electricity because that's going to be cheaper in the long run because we're going to be using renewable. Well, then we need to have the same attitude to water. We need to have buildings assessed on their water usage, and they should have a rating system displayed on the front of their buildings saying how many stars they're worth in terms of water usage. Are they 5-star or are they 1? And I think most of our buildings probably come in at -1 at the moment. Yeah. It's possible to change all of this. The technology is there.
When you say that they could cool them with electricity, do you mean some sort of refrigeration type system?
Fans. Over in California, they're not allowed to use water to cool their towels. I was just looking that up this morning before I came on here. So you could, you know, they're choosing evaporative cooling because it's cheaper than running fans, right? You can have a dry cooling system. I'm not an engineer. I don't really understand all the technicalities there, but I do understand at the moment it's clearly cheaper to use water to cool your data centres than it is to run fans to keep them cool.
Mm. Oh, well, that's important. They've got to make money.
And the other thing about evaporative... Sorry, Kevin. The other thing about evaporative cooling is that's where you get your Legionnaire's disease from, isn't it, sometimes? So, yeah,
yes.
Anyway, let's not go down that path. Look, my Maribyrnong River needs 7 billion litres of water now. We've been waiting 19 years. How much longer do we have to wait, or are we supposed to say, kiss the platypus goodbye in the west of Melbourne? You don't matter enough as people to be able to enjoy our Australian wildlife because you're in the west.
Mm.
And we're taking the urban growth hit. We took the hit for industry and we haven't had successful restorative action on the river. We've still got highly contaminated sediments, right? Which you probably don't want to disturb. But the point is, the people of the West deserve the same chance to have reasonable amenity like the rest of Melbourne, and we're not getting it now. We didn't have it in the past, and I think it's long overdue that restorative action was taken in these communities.
Long, long overdue, I think. Helen, it was probably, I can't think of how many decades ago now, but in my working journalist days, I actually coined the phrase the deprived West, which took off at the time and got them some money. And that was around, that was when the Whitlam government was in.
Government, in the year leading up to the December 72 election, Tom Roper called a community forum for a weekend over, it was what was then Footscray Institute of Technology, which is now Vic Uni. And the community rocked up there all day Saturday and Sunday because Yoss and I went to it. And we said we were sick of being the deprived West and we wanted libraries, sewerage, education, better health, some of the things, and better transport. Because even then, there were suburbs that didn't have a bus line or a tram line or a train line, right?
Mm.
Now, and that was when the Western, that was when the councils got together and started lobbying as a region, and we got a growth in libraries, we got better, we had the, I remember teaching at a school that got a particular grant because we were low socioeconomic, and that lifted up, that lifted the resources in that school. When a federal government leads in a way that says we're going to respect the people and we're going to invest in the people and the things that they're, that are central for their a good quality of life, it creates pride and it creates better outcomes and it reduces the health burden on the nation as well. Right.
Well, Tom Yorenge department threw a lot of money into that regional council out there at that time, which was good at the time, yeah.
It was wonderful, and we can do that again because, I mean, we've got very proactive... The councils in the Maribyrnong region, which is Macedon, Hume, Brimbank, Moonee Valley and Maribyrnong, they're used to working together collectively, right? And they share similar problems and well, similar challenges, right? And they have a positive view. We like our diversity. We like our multilingual, multi-faith communities, right? We like the open plains of the West. We love our grasslands and the species that we have that are unique to us. And we want to keep them. But we have a biodiversity crisis, a water crisis, and a clean air issue because we've got so many freeways and airports. So all of these things matter to the way people live. And yet we don't have the investment we need sufficiently from either the federal or the state government to treat us as equal to other people in the state or the nation.
Yeah. We've only got about 5 minutes left, Helen, but I do want to touch on also something you've raised many times, and I mentioned it earlier, the question of the residue from tyres getting into waterways. There was a report now that says government should act urgently because they're one of the big polluters of waterways.
Well, I've only been saying that for 20 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Yeah. Look, toxicant treatment system. You've got stormwater pits. The water goes into the pit and then down into the drain, right? All you have to do is install a treatment system. Now, these systems are available on small and massive scales, right? There's plenty of people. You can go and buy them in Australia right now. You put them in the stormwater pits. You do it over time and you gradually take and you take out. You have gravel and sand and activated carbon, which has to be removed regularly because that's where the chemical pollution is captured. Now, if you can prevent it going into the rivers, you're going to improve your fishing opportunities in your rivers as well, right? You're going to improve the water quality. You're going to help the platypus. You're going to help the yabbies. You're going to help the dragonflies that are trying to develop in the creek, which is part of the food web for the water birds. It just makes sense to do it all, Kevin. This is, again, requiring investment. And if the standard of living is not to decline, then we all need to understand we have to support government investment. And if that means increasing the cost of things, it's something we have to face up to. We can't say we want, we need to do certain things, therefore we have a responsibility to find the revenue for it, right? Those decisions aren't going to be easy to make, but they have to be made because it's rational to say these are essential for life. This is what it's going to cost us. Therefore, we need to raise this amount of money. I mean, I didn't go off and buy a $2 million house, did I? I had to buy a house that was within my household budget. Well, in this case, the government's got to look at how are people going to have drinking water. How are people going to have access? I mean, in the West, most of the open space runs along the creek corridors, right? This is where people go for jogging, cycling, walking, going for a chat with their friends. This is the area where public health is being maintained by having access and contact with nature. If those areas become dry waterbeds in the future because we didn't look after our rivers, that'll be a shame. And we can capture that stormwater and reuse it. We can capture the recycled water, use recycled water and bring it up to better qualities. We have the solutions at our fingertips. What we lack is the drive from government and the investment from government.
And also, of course, it wouldn't hurt to try and get less and less cars and trucks on the road and onto other forms of transport as well, which would help also help the situation.
Kevin, the Public User Transport Group has been crying out for public transport and rail instead of road for decades. I remember going to a meeting in the 1990s and where we had an expert from Western Australia to explain to us that we could, for the cost of what was going to be a freeway at the time, we could simply spend less money and increase public transport for less. And did we do it? No.
Of course not. No.
But the point is, once all the... one of the programs that I really like that the government's done is that getting rid of the railway crossings, right? Because, one, it's a lot safer, and, two, it's a lot quicker, and it means the trains are going to run more quickly. Now, that expenditure has been well worthwhile, right? And I know some people think it's a waste of time. Well, I don't. It's been it's a sensible thing to do if you're going to get your trains to run more quickly, right? Now, we know the cost of that, and yet that cost is being borne by us today and into the future because the Liberal governments prior to them didn't bother to do it. And yet because the city has now expanded so much, we've again got a public transport deficit and we've still got too many trucks on the road. I mean, I don't like driving down through Buller anymore because, you know, you've got there is a three-lane road there. But the number of quarry trucks that are heading out to the housing developments around Sunbury, it's a bit frightening, really, when you're just meeting one after the other of those.
We're going to have to wind up here, Helen, because time's up, unfortunately. But all that proves is we're going to have to talk to you again at some stage because it just goes on and on, doesn't it?
Well, thank you, Kevin. But water is essential for life. We need urgent action, and I think the government has got the knowledge there in the bureaucracy. The technology's available, and it's up to them to
Helen.
For the west of Melbourne.
Thanks for your time, Helen Vandenberg. Thanks a lot for that. And okay, thanks, Zeb, for keeping us on air. Thanks, Karina, too, for making those phone calls for us. So
Thank you.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.